This meeting to order at 6:06 PM. So thank you for to all those that are here attending the OFCY Riverside Commission meeting. We'll start with roll call. So we'll start with Commissioner Bill Riley.
Present.
Kimberly Aceves. Langston Budenhagen. Peter Lay.
Present.
Dwayne Davis. Ankarita Allen. Jorge Velasco.
Present.
Betty Booker. And Tassian Kwamalele, present. So that is our roll call. And at this time, we will continue to follow the agenda. And I believe we have open form. So if anyone or anyone that's in the, that's attendees would have comment, I believe you raise your hand and you will be elevated to speak.
You can actually move Langston into, oh, he's in, is here now as a panelist.
Yes.
Hi, everybody. I'm so sorry I'm late. I was finishing up another meeting with the Youth Advisory Board for the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force.
Okay.
Great.
So we have no speakers for open forum?
Nope.
Awesome. So we'll go to the third agenda item. I believe we do have quorum now. Believe so. So we'll have approval of prior meeting minutes from November 4th, 2020. And I know they were sent out and hopefully we all had a chance to review.
Yeah. Yeah, Madam Chair, I'll move the meeting minutes for the previous meeting to be accepted.
Awesome. I'll second that motion.
Awesome. Ready for the questions? All those in favor? We'll say aye. Should we go down roll call to get the actual list?
Yep.
Great. So we'll start again with the same order. So Bill Riley.
Aye.
Langston Budenhagen.
Aye.
Peter.
Aye.
Jorge Velasco.
Aye.
And Tassian Kwamalele. Aye. Awesome. So that is now taken care of. Thank you all. And now we will have the overview of the POC 2021 work in action for the year.
Yes. I just wanted to, so let me dive to that. That's that, there's a timeline in your packet. You would have received following the PowerPoint, which we included for the record, from in the minutes from the last meeting, but there's a timeline which is just really sort of broadly giving you a better idea of how strategic planning sort of timeline will flow, and as well the Planning and Oversight Committee work forecast through September 2021. We wanted to go up to the point where we would hope that the board can have final adoption of the strategic investment plan to the City Council and the Life Enrichment Committee in by September 2021. I'm going to start with just highlights of that forecast, and since we want to get to the presentation, I will go quickly, and I do though want to take the time to have you look at this, and if you have any questions, we want to address them. It's always good to have a view ahead if you're in planning mode. And so I'll start with the 2021 work forecast. This meeting is really dedicated to getting a training on racial equity presentation from the Department of Race and Equity. Advancing equity through the strategic planning process is really core to the work that we're going to be doing this year. And so we want to sort of launch the process with this. And then going into January, the work of the Planning and Oversight Committee would move to really starting to look at the OCY vision, mission, and values and re-envision that. So we've got some context laid this meeting and taking the time to think, envisioning sort of guiding principles. It's really up to the Planning and Oversight Committee. That would be facilitated process, of course. And hoping to use the January meeting and even possibly sort of February meeting to focus your work more envisioning sort of desired goals and outcomes. And so this is really sort of really the beginning of a strategic planning process. We would have in January the strategic plan subcommittee also launching and beginning to review the data and help to support identifying needs in the landscape that exists for investing in children and youth in Oakland. There would also be discussing, with the data in mind, sort of community engagement plan and where we want to spend the resources that we have to really get community input and to use the data analysis to support, that work and get a plan together for that. February, I think that we probably will need, we may need more time to have the POC focusing on the setting of goals for this work. Strategic subcommittee would continue with community engagement activities with our consultants and learnings, et cetera. We will also plan toward the end of February to take the evaluation report to the Life Enrichment Committee, and that is an opportunity as well for the co-chairs to be present and to support delivery of the evaluation. In this particular year, this is for the 1920 evaluation. I think it will also, incorporate some of the findings that we have and we know from the SPR, Social Policy Research Associates as the evaluator, just around the impact of COVID-19 and how the agencies are working in the current situation. And then in March, again, there would be an opportunity to receive the summer evaluation report from SPR and as well to start to think about the renewal of the summer grants in the current funding cycle. We will have the subcommittee working, of course, in strategic planning to support delivering community needs assessment and the racial equity analysis and helping to frame and guide all this work. And by April, we're hoping to support receiving the summary of the community engagement findings, or at least a preliminary summary. And let's see here. And doing, of course, much more work with regard to strategic planning is happening at the subcommittee level, community engagement level, et cetera, and even beginning to work with the subcommittee around prioritizing and drafting potential strategies coming out of the goals and the community engagement. We also would want the commission as a whole to be looking at reviewing and approving the grant awards for fiscal year 21-22. This would be year three of the three-year grant cycle. So every year in the spring, we need to think through, we're either renewing the grants or going through a review process to approve new grants. So this would be the year three process. Just to state that we are in the middle of a financial crisis with the city of Oakland. And so, as we get more information about what that looks like, we would want to bring that, that information back to the Planning and Oversight Committee. And that might, again, as it did last year, really, help steer some of that discussion and decision-making. And then, of course, in May, there's more work on strategic planning, and we would want to get an informational report or some kind of report to the Life Enrichment Committee or the City Council as a whole. Partly, this depends on what they're able to take on. They will also be really working on the city's budget. So that always has a determination. By June, we are hoping to go forward with the renewal of the grants to Life Enrichment Committee and to have that recommendation before the council for approval. So we have to know at that point any budget changes, and we also have to have gone through our own renewal process. And of course, the Strategic Planning Committee will be working on developing this draft strategic investment plan, and we'll be going through sort of a review and comment process around strategies with the public and reporting out to hopefully the City Council with a draft plan by July. So that's pretty much, you know, the work that's engaging this year. There will be time to review, revise, and strengthen the strategic investment plan if there's input, and we would love to get the City Council to approve the strategic plan based upon the POC's action in September or October. So we just wanted you to see this, you know, for a moment and process as you can, so that you have a better idea of what we mean when what's in our heads around moving through the upcoming months and weeks. And we had a little bit more to sort of spec out, and these are very broad strokes around the strategic planning timeline and overview. And so again, you know, take a look at that, you know, when you can at your leisure. What's most, you know, imminent is really laying the context as is going to happen with this meeting, and having some discussion, and then moving into more of a process about a vision and values, guiding principles, and desired goals and outcomes. And so we'll be working on that in January, February. So I will leave it there, and there is time for questions or discussion. I mean, any feedback you have is fine, and we will take that now before we go on to introducing Darlene.
Yeah, I had a... go ahead, Tassion.
Go, Peter. Okay. Oh, you go, Peter.
I just had a quick question. I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So I know in one of our previous meetings, we talked about forming the strategic plan subcommittee, but I also know that there was... another committee, like an evaluation, like ad hoc subcommittee. Is that reflected anywhere in this timeline?
Mike, you want to speak to what's happened with the evaluation subcommittee and the strategic planning subcommittee? I think we've moved into forming that, so I'll let him address it.
Sure. And so the evaluation subcommittee is the one standing committee of the POC. They usually meet once a year, if not twice. They didn't meet in October to get the draft final evaluation report, and that's what they presented to the POC in November that you adopted. The strategic planning subcommittee is the ad hoc one, and right now we have three POC members who want to participate: Peter, Bill Riley, and Kimberly Aceves have volunteered to participate. Right. And that subcommittee will really hopefully be deeply involved in the planning work as the leaders of the POC, about helping to direct it, be immersed in the data and the direction for the community engagement and what people are saying as far as what they see as priorities and what kind of outcomes they want to see, how kind of strategies can meet the needs in the community. So we look for that committee to start up in late January and then meet 4 to 5 times between January and June. So we should set a date at the end of this meeting around, we'll work with Caitlin as the staff to help set that up. As an ad hoc committee, that meeting could meet whatever time is best for you guys and for the committee. So we'll want to work with Kimberly as well. And Tassion is a chair. Of course, you're welcome to be there. We look to not have more than half the POC because we need to keep under quorum. And then one other aspect would be, once we do a better job on youth recruitment and filling out some of these youth vacancies, is to make sure we have a youth voice and participation as much as possible.
Yeah. To be clear, the council appoints youth and adults. And we have strenuously tried to get the youth appointments as well as adult appointments from council members. So we won't go into that now, but, you know, I'll help in forwarding and reaching out that you have suggestions is definitely appreciated.
Yeah, no, I would say I was glad to just hear the comment about just receiving an update of how the city's budget shortfalls is going to impact the work that we do. I think that is something that, that's the first thing that came to mind when that story first dropped. And so I think it'll be really great to get updates there. And then with, as you were commenting about alignment from council members to get members to, you know, appoint both adults and youth to the board, I would like to give some, I don't know, this is probably not the time, but I think at some point, I think as a board member, I think I can definitely give some insight, because I know it took a minute for me to get appointed just because the system and how it's set up to appoint people was a little confusing. And so I'm not sure if council members all have the same information of what process they need to go by that could be beneficial to clarify.
Okay, well, we can definitely, you know, Tazian, I think it's a really important piece. It's been confusing since the city introduced what they call the Granica system. And because the council members appoint our POC directly, I think it can be very confusing. But nonetheless, I mean, I think that you and I, we should definitely meet and just, you know, have some conversation about how we can, you know, if there's any other better supports to support the council members in making the appointments. I definitely would appreciate that.
Got it.
Yep.
So if there's no other comments on our work in action for the year, we'll move to our presentation from Darlene Flynn from the Department of Race and Equity. And she'll be using a racial equity framework in OFCY strategic planning. So thank you, Director Flynn, for being here with us. And the floor is yours.
Thank you so much for providing time for me to come and be with you. It's great to be here. Things are really busy in the city. I heard, I was working away here, but I could hear Sandra alluding to some of the things that we're dealing with this week. It's a busy time. We really appreciate the volunteers that help us move our work forward, and that's y'all. So thank you for being here in spite of all of the challenges that are impacting our lives. I've been here in the city for about 4 years. I was recruited specifically to stand up the Department of Race and Equity. And over those 4 years, we've been training people and building capacity across the city to implement racial equity in an integrated way in our regular work. It's not a standalone activity. It's the goal is to integrate it into the work that we are already doing. And this RFP that you all are about to undertake is a great example of that. So what I wanted to do was give you a bit of a theoretical overview of how we talk about race and equity. And then segue pretty quickly into some slides that I got from a national expert on result-based accountability, Erica Burnaby. I use some of her work too, because I think that because of the kind of work that your RFP is aimed at, that this work of the fund is aimed at, really what you all are going to be doing is tuning up a little bit to be more explicitly within the equity framework. You've got a lot more already happening within your practices over the years that is in alignment with equity. And so I'm going to talk really specifically about what the elements are and how you can think about, or some things that I've been thinking about that I wanted to suggest to you. And you, hopefully at the end, will also be able to engage in a conversation about what else this presentation makes you think about. Because you know more about your content than I do. I have the equity expertise and the result-based accountability expertise, but I don't have the content knowledge that you all have. So we want to bring these two things together tonight. And I'm going to be as specific as I can be, because people seem to like specificity. How does this apply? What does this mean? How does it apply to our work? I'll try and seed the conversation with a little bit of that, but I expect that you all will be able to build on this considerably. And you can know that Sandy can bring me back at any time as you get into it. I am an internal consultant. I'm an internal resource. already paid for by your tax dollars. So as you move through the process, which is going to be going on for a while, I can always come back to. So don't feel like we have to figure it all out tonight. And there's a lot going on, right? We all know that. So I did bring a PowerPoint deck to keep me on track and to help maybe make the work a little bit easier to be able to think about in this framework. For some of you, I did that wrong. It's not going to be very new. You will have already been exposed to some of this framework because it's not completely original. This is the way the work is being done across the country. I have done this in the wrong order, so I'm a little distracted here. Oh, and now my computer's going to tell me I blew it. So, just do it. Just go for it. I think I might have confused it. I've been having some technical difficulties all day, but they do tend to...
I believe she's muted, so hopefully it'll reboot soon. I think she's going to have to totally re-enter the meeting.
Yep, she just left.
We'll give her, she'll come back.
She hasn't texted you or anything, Sandra, has she?
No. Caitlin, are you getting anything?
I'm checking my email and I haven't received anything.
Uh-oh. You want to send her?
It's possible that her computer crashed and completely and she had to reboot. I mean, that's possible. I will certainly send her another email with the link.
Having Wi-Fi, but you could send her the link again and we can hold on and hope because she's a...
Well, it's great to see your wonderful faces before we end this sporadic year that has been 2020.
That was funny watching you try to find a kind word for this year.
Sporadic's good. I haven't heard that one used yet. I like that.
I like to say 2020 as a collective has definitely been challenging. I think this is, I don't know, in my lifetime, I can say this is the first time I've seen us as an entire human race struggle together. And so we all aligned there. But I would say personally, this has been a great year. So just hoping for better in 2021. And I think we have Director Flynn connecting, which is super exciting. Director Flynn?
Yes.
Awesome. We're so happy to have you back. I guess your presentation is going to be that amazing. You just shut the whole system down.
Did everybody get kicked out?
No, it was just you.
Just me. I did get kicked out and then everything froze. So I really apologize for that.
No problem. Well, the floor is yours and we are ready for your presentation.
All right, let me see if I can successfully share my screen without blowing things up. That's what I was trying to do before, so I'm a little nervous. But hopefully, and I'm also now, all my materials appearing on the wrong screen, but that's okay. I can live with that as long as I can get the PowerPoint to come up for you all.
Darlene, if you continue to have issues with that, feel free to send it to me and I can share from here.
Well, that's a thought. The problem is I usually my PowerPoints are a little bit big for email, or I would have already sent it to you. It usually doesn't work out. It doesn't work when I try to do it. I try to email it. So let me just see if I can.
I would also recommend, Dr. Flynn, if you are sometimes turning your camera off will help with connectivity issues.
That's a good idea. I have this feeling that it's not connectivity, that I'm actually having some sort of a computer problem. It's been acting funny. Well, it could be connectivity. Who knows what it is? It's not doing the things it normally does when my internet goes unstable. It's doing new and different things.
Okay.
But that, you know, that doesn't mean my problem right now is I'm not finding my email present. My because of my screen being wrong, I'm not seeing what I'm going for. I feel like the fates are against me here. I do so many presentations. This is really unusual to have this much trouble. And I'm feeling a little concerned about whether or not this is going to work. It is not providing me with all the choices that I need. And I know the file is open, but it's not making itself visible. So it could be a PowerPoint glitch. It was when I went to open, I see PowerPoint has shut itself down. That's why it wasn't open. I am so sorry.
No problem.
Yeah, this is something a little bit bigger because I did not close PowerPoint. It closed itself. Reopen the file. Let's see if we can. That's why I couldn't see it to share. All right, now screen. This time it should be visible, and there it is. Oh, hallelujah.
Awesome.
So tell me if you can see it, can you?
Yes.
Yes.
All right, I'll make it big for you. Hope that wasn't a mistake. Asking one thing too many of the system. So you'll see that I've shared credit here because the person who trained me to share information about result-based accountability has had a great deal to do with this work. And the way that equity work has evolved over time is that it incorporates more than one discipline in order to get all the things in place that we need. There we go. And now things are behaving a little bit more normally. Yeah. So result-based accountability was developed for government to be better at being government. And Erica Brennaby did the work of merging result-based accountability with the equity framework that we use, which was really a brilliant move because result-based accountability is a good discipline. One of the things she always shares is that you can't be neutral on a moving train, since Howard Zinn. And the point that we try to make is that the train is going where the train is going to go unless we make a move. But the train will take us with it to its usual destination if we don't make those moves, if we don't change directions, if we don't steer the direction in some other way. It's as though these tracks have been laid down and we're stuck on them, except for we're not really stuck on them. We just haven't necessarily exercised all the choices that we could make in order to achieve greater equity in our outcomes. So why such an intentional focus on equity? Well, this goes to the fact that work done with the best of intentions does not necessarily produce the racial equity that we demand or that we long for in our communities, or it already would have. There's plenty of good intentions and have always been good intentions. We are determined here in the city of Oakland not to let the train take us where it has always gone. We want it, but that means we have to build these new pathways to equity. And that's why these kinds of conversations and capacity building training situations are necessary, because building a new pathway doesn't just happen in a haphazard way or in an accidental way. It has to be very intentional. So if equity is what we want, then equity is what we must focus on. And we have a set of working assumptions that we've adopted. These were actually developed by the Annie A. Casey Foundation. And one of the exciting things about what has happened around equity work nationally is that in the last 15 years that I've been involved in it, started this methodology or approach that we're using started about 15 years ago in Seattle, Washington, where I'm from. And in the intermittent 15 years, in the interceding 15 years, so many other organizations have started to work on this too. And so we've been able to pull their work in as we go. And they pull our work in, and it's become very iterative. So this set of assumptions is very helpful in focusing new audiences. Many of you, I'm not going to be telling you anything new when I say these assumptions, but other people haven't necessarily thought about it as much as we have. Race matters. Almost every indicator of well-being shows troubling disparities by race. And of course, we published the Equity Indicator Report for the City of Oakland. I'll probably be referring to that later. It's 72 indicators that all show troubling disparities by race and show particular groups, African-Americans and Indigenous people are most impacted by those disparities. And then there's a range of impacts for other people of color groups as well. So all people of color are impacted by these racial disparities, and some groups are more impacted than others. Disparities are often created and maintained inadvertently through policies and practices that contain barriers to opportunity, and we are most often not even aware that they're there. That's why we say inadvertently, because we haven't focused on what the barriers are. We haven't seen them yet. So a lot of our work is learning to see them. It's possible and only possible to close equity gaps by using strategies determined through intentional focus on race. If race is a problem, if race matters, then we're going to have to take race into account in order to get it right. Now, here in California and also in Washington State, we have some constraints on how we can take race into consideration. Because of Prop 209 here in California, the same exact measure was passed in Washington. It's called I-200. And so we have to work indirectly sometimes when we're designing programs. We can't design race-specific programs or do affirmative action under these initiatives. But that does not mean we have to ignore race as a factor and race racial disparities as something that we need to plan to address. It's just how we address it becomes different as a result of Prop 209, not whether or not we address it. So that's an important distinction, because sometimes people, as a matter of fact, when I got here, people were very confused about that. And they told me that we couldn't do this work here in Oakland because, some people told me, because of Prop 209. And I said, that's funny, because Washington State has Prop I-200, and we've been doing this work in Seattle for over 10 years. It's all about the how, not the what. So it's possible and only possible to close gaps by being intentional about race. And if opportunities in all key areas of well-being then are equal or equitable, then the outcomes will be equitable. So if we don't have equity in our outcomes, then that means that we don't have equity in our inputs. This is a simple logic statement. One does not happen without the other. You're not going to get equitable outcomes without having equity strategies and intentionality and practices. So that's why we keep focusing. Given the right message, analysis, and tools, people will work toward racial equity. And some of you might be thinking, not everybody will. And maybe someone's even thinking, I don't want to. That sounds, you know, fill in the blank. But the point of this is that we don't actually need everyone. We just need enough. We also have borrowed from the tipping point of change theory that comes out of plenty of study about institutions, organizations, and society and how we change, because we do change. And we change when we take on these intentional movement directions, we actually change with intentionality. And we need people to help us do that. And that is the critical mass that we are working to build inside the city of Oakland. And I would say right now we're in a movement time that goes beyond the city of Oakland. I think there's a lot of this activity going on in many, many locations at this time because of current conditions and the elevation of visibility of racial disparities and racial distress in our country. So we know that if we structure this well and give people what they need to do the work, we will be able to achieve critical mass. We believe that. We also have to define equity, because although it's a pretty simple word, it's not universally understood in the same way. And we want to make sure when we're doing the work that we're talking about the same thing. I'm sure you've all seen this image before or a version of it. There are many versions of it now. It has evolved over the years. This is the one I'm currently using and looking for my next best one. But this is the contrast of equality versus equity as a stance, as a strategy. Equality strives to treat everyone the same, which would work fine if everyone had always been treated the same and we did not have a history of disenfranchisement, disinvestment, and restricting people's access to opportunity. And so that's represented in the equality slide in both slides by the difference in the elevation that the people are standing on. So when you treat everyone the same in conditions that were shaped by a history that has not been the same, we don't achieve opportunity for all, because people are not all starting in the same place. Sometimes people refer to this as the different starting line. Black, Indigenous, and people of color start in a different place than the group that is identified as white in our society. And that's a function of history, not choice. And so we do talk a lot more than I'm going to tonight about the history of how it got like this, because part of the reason that people don't just understand this extent instinctively is because of our poor education about race and racism in this country. And without re-educating and relearning U.S. history as compared to the standard U.S. history that was taught in school, we don't understand and we misinterpret. And in fact, there's a whole narrative about why it is the way it is that is not accurate, and therefore it keeps us operating in smog and we can't make the best decisions. So we use the equity framework you see on the right. And that is understanding that in order for all to have access, we can't treat everybody the same for a while. We're trying to get to the place where we can. That is our ultimate goal. But before we can just assume treating everybody the same will work in the outcomes, we have to actually close those disparities. Once we close those disparities, then we that's our vision way out in the future, we'll be able to do that. But right now, we're working on this space in between these two pictures. And that is the change work we're trying to do. So equity is fair and just inclusion. An equitable society is one in which all can actually participate and prosper. The goals of equity must be to create conditions, and that means conditions in communities of Black, Indigenous, people of color that allow all to reach their full potential. And we know we do not have that. Now, there are literally thousands of examples of how that is not the current situation. And so it is that closing of the gap that we're working on. And our approach creates a path from hope to actual change, change in our institutions, change in our, even our, perhaps our distribution of resources. And by the way, in this image, the fence represents our institution. That fence was designed and built in that way to operate, probably to keep people out. There are a lot of things in our society that sort people and track people in different directions. And it's built into those policies of those institutions, as well as into the history of this country. So we have control over how we construct our processes, our programs, our policies, our laws. We have control over that. We can change the way that fence looks. It does not have to be as much of a barrier as it is. So we can work on both distribution of resources, but also on the structures themselves that are keeping people away from opportunity. And the work we're doing creates the pathway to do that, the how-to to do that. We also use equity principles. In doing our equity work, we're system-focused and outcome and data-driven. And the outcome we're going for is the elimination of racial disparities. And the systems we're looking at is any that we can get our hands on. But we start with the ones that are closest to us. So we're working on city systems. But certainly we have influence probably over some other systems, or at least we have relationships and contacts. And eventually we'll be able to go beyond our system. But if we don't start with our system, it's going to be hard for us to show others the way. So we're practicing on ourselves because that's where we have the greatest control. A part of our work is to shift individuals like myself and anyone else in the city of Oakland, and you all, to the degree that you engage this work, is to shift individuals from gatekeepers to agents of institutional transformation, or change agents, or advocates. There's a lot of different vocabulary that that applies here, but the idea is that going from just following it, from just implementing the things that are, to thinking about how do the things that are need to be changed in order to make them more fair and just. It's almost like we're expanding our world of what our responsibilities are in this process. Certainly we could, we could vest a pension and keep a roof over our heads without being change agents, but that is not what we're striving for. We believe that we as public employees and volunteers working on public issues can have much more impact than that. And we want to step into that opportunity. We want to take actions to identify and address institutional elements of racism. And in this case, when we say racism, we just mean policies, practices, and procedures that work really well for white people but don't work well for Black, Indigenous, people of color. That's that kind of racism, that systemic racism that differentiates not even through intentional action, but through the way it's constructed. Again, think about the fence and that sort of thing. The way it's constructed actually creates an impact that is racialized and is therefore an element of or indicative of systemic racism. We want to stay grounded in history and root causes of racial inequity. We don't want to be ahistorical, because again, if we're ahistorical, then we draw the wrong assumptions about why people are where they are and why they're experiencing what they're experiencing. And while individual choices matter, the context that we make those choices in matters as much or more. So we have got to keep grounded in what's really going on here and what are we actually trying to undo. And then finally, we want to make sure that we become more accountable to those who are most impacted by racial disparities. And I'm just going to be really clear and say that institutions in their typical ways are least accountable to those who are most impacted by racial disparities. Those who are impacted by racial disparities is the definition of marginalized communities. They are synonymous. So when we say marginalized or disinvested, those are the same communities that are impacted by racial disparities. And to those people, institutions tend to have the least accountability, because being marginalized because of race flows from not having socioeconomic and political power. So that lack of power, which is no fault of their own, because this power is handed out based on other identifiers, or by certain identifiers that counts us out, we have less influence over decision-making, outcomes of elections. I mean, you can see how that happens. There's all kinds of ways that Black, Indigenous, and people of color are still being disenfranchised today. We think of it as something long, long ago and far, far away, but it is not. It is very real today, and it's a result of the history of this nation. So usually here I pause. I'm not going to do it tonight because we lost a little bit of time, but I just, in your mind, be thinking about who are we typically accountable to? And delivering services to people is not the same as accountability. I'm sure you all know that. That service recipients are one thing. People to whom we're accountable are another. The dynamic around that is completely different. Service delivery can be completely unaccountable and often is. We want to change that as part of this work, because as we change our accountability or expand our accountability to include those who have historically not been recognized in this way, we will have better outcomes. It just will change us. It will change us just through the motions of becoming accountable to a different group of people. Now, that doesn't mean we get to abandon all of our other accountabilities. I know that. We'll still be, we just want to expand it because we're already accountable to, I mean, if we had time to brainstorm it, we could list a whole lot of people that we have accountabilities to. But it's unlikely that Black, Indigenous, and people of color would be honestly on that list. So in order to do this work, we use a really structured approach that helps us be accountable to those communities. It's built into the equity process. We do this, we use this tool called the Racial Equity Impact Analysis. And I think I heard Sandy say something about that as she was working earlier in the agenda. This idea of a racial equity impact analysis is done in a very particular way. And the way that it is done is it starts out being very driven by the outcome that you're going for. And I put in some placeholder statements here. The first thing we do before we have any idea how we're going to get there, we worry about the where are we trying to go and defining that really well. In this particular case, I picked economically secure. All residents of the city of Oakland are economically secure and living in thriving, healthy communities. When we name future outcomes, they're usually named in present tense, or they're said in present tense as though that it's already true. This enables us to then take that statement, all residents of the city of Oakland are economically secure and living in thriving, healthy communities, and interrogate it with the question, who is not experiencing that now? And that's where we get to racial disparities. African American, Latinos, and some Asian groups are overrepresented in poverty, unemployment, underemployment, living with poor health outcomes, and shorter life expectancy. So that having a future outcome that we can contrast and compare to helps us get to who and what groups in our city are not currently enjoying that outcome. But the truth of the matter is that probably about a third of the city of Oakland is already there. And that's good news. About a third of the city of Oakland is already economically secure and living in thriving, healthy communities. About another two-thirds is not. So we're going to focus on the two-thirds that is not. Not because we don't care about the folks that are already there, but because the folks that are already there are already there. And we're focused on closing the disparities. We want to keep them there, but we want to close the disparities between those and communities of color in the city of Oakland. So then we turn to working with those very communities to complete root cause analysis, to deepen understanding of the problem, and to determine what partnerships and actions are needed to respond comprehensively. Now, it's very important for me to lean in on step three here and say, CBOs are not proxies for the people who are impacted by racial disparities. It is the people themselves whose wisdom we need. Doesn't mean we need to talk to everyone, but we need to talk to enough people. We need to contact and engage and be in proximity with, even though right now we're not within proximity of anyone, but get closer to the people that we do not normally hear from and that we do not normally consider to have wisdom in the same way that we expect other people to have wisdom and knowledge. But in fact, they have key insights that we must have. And if they are filtered through CBOs, they will come through the filter of the CBO. We want to get information that comes directly from the people into our thinking. We also will consult with CBOs because they have valuable information too, but it's not the same information. And so it's not the same experience. It's not necessarily ever been part of the experience or is not at this moment likely to be part of the experience. And if it is, when they're speaking, they will still have their CBO, their community-based organization hat on. Of course they will, just like I always have my city hat on. So that's step three, is got to get with some community and got to do the extra steps to connect with people that don't normally just come and connect with us in our usual processes. So we focus on that quite a bit in helping city staff understand how to engage differently and how not to rely on the old, only on the old mechanisms. This is a very important step. It's like the missing ingredient. It's like if you're baking a cake and you left out the eggs or some other ingredient that is critical to the alchemy of baking a good cake. This is actually the missing ingredient that keeps us stuck, I think, in many cases. We work really hard to get it right, but we're missing a crucial ingredient in our baking exercise. So we want to do that. And it isn't until after we've done step one, two, and three that we get actually to designing and problem solving. And here we want to make sure that we're designing and problem solving with an eye toward rigorous performance measures. And we want our design to address root causes of disparities. And we want our design to remove barriers into, in this case, economic security. We want to be as rigorous as we can be without regard to what we have the resources to do in the moment. Because if we only address the part of the elephant that we have the money for or the time or the, you know, bandwidth, we will leave the rest of it out. And if we leave the rest of it out, if we don't even know that it's there and it needs to be addressed, we're not going to get the outcomes that we're hoping for because we're too narrowly focused. Now, that doesn't mean we can always provide everything that is needed in order to actually get to where we're trying to go, to get to that desired future condition. But if we have a thorough analysis of what it would take to get there, that's when we can start looking to partnerships and other strategies. To backfill where we don't have everything that we need to have to get there. And we certainly can also up our game in the process. We can tune our game up and we can build partnerships and collaborations to work overtime to fill the areas that we don't have the capacity to fill, either financially or expertise or maybe jurisdiction. So, but it isn't until step four. I want you to just let that sink in. When we go into processes, assuming that we already know what the answers are and that we already have everything we need to get the answers right, we leave a lot on the table and we lose our opportunity to improve our game and to change in the direction that we need to change in. So it is step four needs to happen after the interrogation, steps one, two, and three. And then, of course, I just threw in here five. Repeat two to five as needed. We know that we're not necessarily going to get all the way to the change that we're trying to get in one cycle. And so we learn from each attempt, we plow that learning back in, and we make further adjustments as we go forward. We understand this is developmental, it's learning, it's praxis, it's, you know, there's a lot of words we could use for it. If equity had been an easy thing to figure out, it would have already been done. We're building it as we go. We're making the way by walking. So we expect to continue to monitor our impacts and make course corrections as needed. So these are kind of the basic slides about what we're doing in the city and how we're thinking about creating a more equitable city. But there are more tools. There are lots of tools. They're the tools that we use that I've been working with for the last 15 years. But this result-based accountability is another tool. And the goal of the tool is to change direction. It is not to validate what we're always doing. It is not to make us feel accomplished and like we're finished. It is actually to challenge us and the whole city, not just you, or not just the Open Fund for Children and Youth. It's about everything we do. That's the other thing, is no one area is going to fix it completely. This is something we're doing across the city, multidisciplinary, and these things need to come together also, and I'm going to talk about that later too. So result-based accountability is another tool. It's data informed, though. It works just like equity. It's community involved. It's transparent decision making. We start at the end to determine what you want to achieve and work backwards to the means. I just showed you a slide that did exactly that. We want to identify the right level of accountability to the right people, population or whole community, long-term closed disparities is our main accountability. And that accountability is to those folks who are impacted by those disparities. Performance measures, programs, services, agency systems, initiatives, where the rubber meets the road. We want to identify the level of accountability that's necessary then too, there too. So we want to think about our accountability differently, about the who and also the what. So we'll break that down some more. This says ask effective questions to quickly get from ends to means. So the whole time it's inquiry. It's inquiry, inquiry, and more inquiry so that we can figure out the right means to get to the end that we agreed to in the beginning that we were trying to get to. We want to use a community-centered racial equity lens as the foundation for the work. We want the data to be interpreted with the community. We want to make sure that it is used consistently and in a justice framework, not to reinforce stereotypes or blame the victim. We want solutions that are chosen with an eye to root cause so that they'll be more likely to work, to disrupt and shift disproportionate outcomes. We want authentic problem solving, and authentic problem solving means authentic relationships with representatives of the community that are most impacted by racial disparities. The group will help encourage and empower people to course correct rather than blame. We want to make sure that we're shifting from a punitive rather than a blameful attitude. We live in a very punitive society, and oftentimes when CBOs or city departments or whoever is, you know, in the spotlight, when we start doing this work, they fear or think we're moving into a punitive process. We are not moving into a punitive process. We are moving into a more empowered process, empowering people to change what we're doing so that we can get to a better place. We can skip right over blame. The assumption is that people who do good work inside the city or outside the city have been doing the best they can with what they've got to work with. We're trying to bring new tools that will get us to a different place, but we do need to buy into that we need to change. But it's not because we're bad people or because we screwed up or because we're being punished. We need to change toward greater effectiveness. So, community leaders and staff are mutually responsible for planning, identifying, collecting, and using data to formulate meaningful solutions. And that includes you all, because you are community leaders. And our humility teaches us that as community leaders, we can't represent everybody, and we haven't had everybody's experience, and we need more. We need to put ourselves in charge of making sure that we're engaging more community leaders, and particularly community leaders in highly marginalized areas of our city. So this non-punitive approach is really important, and it really keeps people scared inside the city, I can tell you that, and probably in other locations as well. So we have to reinforce that often and say we're just trying to get to a better place. This is just continuous improvement. This isn't about blame and shame. But if the system isn't functioning the way that it could function, we're failing. But that's not about blame, that's about fix. It's about fixing it. Data and equity rationale and decision-making process is also shared with the community. So all of this work needs to be disclosed and done as publicly and openly as possible. Our equity decision-making process needs to be reported back. The outcomes of that need to be shared back with the community. This is something that should never just go behind closed doors or into a dark hole and people never find out what happened. This is what often happens with community processes, and we are trying to break that habit too. It's got to be shared back with the community. I'm going fairly quickly because I know you all probably already know this, but I will pause in a minute and ask for questions, I promise. Maybe this is a good place. Any questions at this point? Because I'm going to get a little bit more into using data.
Okay, I just had a question. Back a couple slides ago during the steps 1 through 5.
Uh-huh.
What does economically secure mean? Like, what's that basis?
Economically secure would mean that you have enough money and or other supports that you are not experiencing economic hardship. You can pay your rent, you can buy food, you have access to transportation that you can afford. And there's various ways of getting here. Obviously, the long-term way of getting here would be to make sure that we don't have the huge number of people that we have living in Oakland below the poverty line. Living in the Bay Area below the poverty line, I don't even know how people do it, but we have lots of residents that are doing exactly that. Cost of living here, so it's really, this is about, you wouldn't be experiencing disparities in your access to things that you need in order to thrive and be healthy. Don't have to be rich. This isn't about everybody being economically secure. To me, does not mean you're wealthy.
Understood.
I've never been wealthy, but I've been lucky because for many years now, I've been economically secure. I've been able to earn enough money, in my particular case, to be able to choose to live in a thriving, healthy community, to be able to feed and clothe my children, keep a roof over their heads. It's having enough. Is that helpful?
And is there... Yeah, no, it's great. And then is there a correlation between like crime or trauma with what's defined within living in a thriving and a healthy community?
Well, that is a big debate because I think that what the experts are the conclusion they're coming to is that is not crime is not an automatic response to poverty and economic insecurity, but it is in the United States. Mm. The majority of the people on the planet are poor, just statistically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And not every country or every place has the levels of violence that the US has. And as soon as I say that, I'm sure you're already imagining what are some of the things that are different about the United States, right? So we have to be more, I think that just saying it's because of poverty is way too simplistic. And I think poverty and being stuck in poverty in the United States, a country of great wealth, this is one of the factors that has been pointed to is the disparity from between the top and the bottom. In countries where that's true, you have a little bit more violence. In countries where you have a lot of guns, you have more violence. In countries where there are many factors. So I think that's why we have to see this as being multidisciplinary, and the Oakland Fund for Children and Youth isn't going to be able to solve all the inputs or remove all of the threats or all of the barriers, but we can remove the ones we can remove, and it's also good, right? It's more complicated. Yeah, poverty is just one factor. Good question though, anything else? Data.
Thank you, Doctor.
You're welcome. So, we need to use disaggregated data to inform our decisions. Unfortunately, your programs collect disaggregated data. So, collect data that can be disaggregated, I guess is a better way to put it. There's a lot of disaggregated data. And so this isn't such a hard sell for folks that are in the line of work that you all are in or in the line of volunteering that you all are in. But we want to ask questions about that data. Whose lives are we looking to impact? And we want to make sure that when we look in these different buckets, that we are seeing that we're having the impacts that we want to have. And in order to have those impacts, we're probably going to have to be intentional about how we design our approaches to getting those impacts. Because just when you look at this list of race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, language, et cetera, those all present different kinds of barriers and challenges. So we have to become much more agile about, and one of the ways we get better at it is by getting closer to these populations than city government tends to be. We have a lot between us and the people we serve. And that's problematic actually, because then we're not necessarily putting the right prompts into our contract, in our RFPs and our contract making to actually meet the needs of the different populations that are marginalized in the city of Oakland. We have to get more specific about how we're using the data in our decision-making and how we're tying our decisions or our designs, our program designs, to disparities that are impacting those groups. And within race, we have different challenges for different groups of people. Like I said, Black and Indigenous people have by far the greatest impacts in these racial disparities, and there are reasons for that that are specific to those groups. When you work on issues of in other groups, there are other specific issues that are impacting those groups because our histories are not exactly the same. racism is the same in that it marginalizes all people of color, but it doesn't do it in exactly the same way, and it hasn't had exactly the same history. So we need to know more in that way about what we're working with and think about it in that way to the best of our ability. And we'll get better at it. It gets easier. I guarantee you this can become quite fluid, but it's not at first because it's a different way of thinking about it. And we have some things to learn about how to get it right. We're learning it together. So the result, there's these different terminologies in result-based accountability, and they're also in other places. A result is a condition of well-being for children, adults, families, or communities. It's just a condition of well-being. That's what we're always going for in the city. We're always going for a condition of well-being. That's the point of having government, is to have more, you know, better services that provide greater context for well-being. Indicator is a measure which helps to quantify the result. An indicator, it's data. It can be both quantitative and will be qualitative and quantitative. Both are necessary. One without the other is not as useful. If we only have one, we can start with what we've got and collect the other going forward. If we don't have any, then we will start with what we know, you know, just what we can know, and build the data as we go. Not having data is not a reason not to do result-based accountability or equity work, but we want to strive to have that data in the future if we don't have it now. Y'all have quite a bit of data. You're starting a good place. That's not always true in the city and elsewhere. A performance measure is a measure of how well a program, an agency, or a service is working. How is a specific, you know, program doing? And that is an important area too. So you have indicators, you have performance measures, you have results. All these things are going on at the same time. And we want to touch on all of those. We want to be clear about the results that we're trying to get. We want to have indicators to measure and quantify our results. We also want to measure the performance of specific programs. So it's like layers. So a result is all children are well-educated. All people live in safe communities. All people are economically self-sufficient. This is similar to the example I provided you. A measure would be high school graduation rates, police arrest rates, crime rates, unemployment rates. So indicator, the Oakland Equity Indicator Report, it's full of indicators. And then performance measures are going to be, things like how much did we do? How well did we do it? Is anyone better off? Who is better off? And how do we know? So most of what, you're gonna have all of these layers, but I think a lot of what you're gonna be working with in your RFP is going to be performance measures that tie back to indicators and results. This has a through line through it. So your performance measures at the programmatic level need to support moving the needle on the indicators and need to build the conditions that are described in your result. They're all connected, but they are different things. They just need to be lined up and in alignment. So think about the larger context of your work, to transform systems to get equitable outcomes of color. I think the whole community cannot experience well-being when communities of color experience conditions at a disproportionately low rate, don't have access to healthy environments and economic security. That actually is a cancer on the society, and just or in the society. We tell ourselves, we sort of, I think, as collectively, the collective ignores that we're all in the same boat. But there are some things going on right now that has brought that into stark relief. COVID-19 pandemic is being experienced the way we're experiencing it in this country, largely because of these racial disparities that preexisted COVID-19. It is just drawn out how being situated differently changes your ability to stem the spread of this disease, let alone to survive the disease. So we're seeing how it impacts everyone. So an example of that would be as we fill our hospitals to capacity while we're sitting here, that might not seem like a problem to people who can isolate themselves from exposure, who can work at home like myself, who can have their groceries delivered, who can continue to make a living even during a shutdown or partial shutdown. We feel insulated perhaps from this negativity, but if we were to have a medical emergency, if we were to get into a car accident or have a heart attack, or need cancer treatment that has nothing to do with our maybe socioeconomic status. During this period of time for the next 6 months, it's going to be very, it could be very difficult to get the care that we need in a life-threatening situation when our systems are overwhelmed with COVID-19 running uncontrolled through the community because people could not afford to stay at home, because people are living in conditions that are conducive to spread, et cetera. So we are in the same boat, and in fact, it will eventually impact all of us. You can also look at climate change and the environment in the same way that, you know, some people will be able to protect themselves from climate change longer than others, but eventually it is completely conceivable the planet will become uninhabitable, and that will affect everyone. So not paying attention to the things that we need to pay attention to on the systemic level is actually everyone's problem. And we need to get better at explaining that to people and helping people understand that. The results that we're looking at are healthy versus not sick. We're not trying to focus on just the bad things that are going on. We're trying to focus on where we're trying to get to. We're trying to get to, whether it's we're trying to get to healthy people or we're trying to get to a healthy planet, that's much more motivating. So we do tend to state outcomes in positive, present tense words to inspire and to help us focus on what is possible and how we're going to get there. So there's a little bit of subtle psychology, if you will, embedded in how we talk about this stuff. So think about Oakland and answer the following questions. We're not actually going to do that exercise, but I suggest that you all come back to these exercises. I just want to get through the foundation for you tonight. What is the condition of well-being, the results that you want for people in your community? Stated in positive terms, stated in present tense. What would these conditions look like if you could see or experience them? Describe it like you are Google Earth driving around in this healthy community. And imagine that that healthy community is in the flatlands, by the way. So make sure that you're driving in deep East Oakland and imagine what it would be like in that future condition. And then how would you measure that? So this helps you, this is a mind exercise to help you get deeper into where we're actually trying to go and the more specifics and for each group of people. So when you're being Google Earth, think about Black folks, think about Indigenous folks, think about Latinos and Asians, particularly Asians who are immigrant and refugee status or have been recently immigrants or refugees. Think about what would be different in those communities in the future that we're working together to create. This helps unlock our creativity and get to a more flexible place about what we might be willing to do or might try to do to get there. Being able to see it, taste it, smell it, you know, revel in it, juices us up in a strange way. A little more psychology, but it actually works. So you want to answer in a culturally relevant, contextualized manner that is connected to the vision. The question is not about any community, again, but about people of color who are most impacted by racial disparities in Oakland when we're doing equity work around race. That's what we're thinking about. Ask yourself, whose vision does this picture reflect? Because sometimes we can project a white middle-class vision onto people of color when that is not what they would consider a healthy community. So it's important for us to think about that. I was doing some homeless work recently with HUD and the county, doing a racial equity impact analysis about homeless services. And one of the things we discovered by talking to Indigenous people, Latinos, and even Black folks, but particularly with Indigenous and Latino people, is a lot of the services that we offer are not useful to those cultural groups. They're not useful to them because they're not culturally relevant, they're not contextualized, and they at the end of the day, they don't help. So we want to make sure that we haven't projected onto different communities something that is coming out of a disconnected place. Well-intended, but disconnected place. Does it reinforce a deficit orientation toward the community? Are we reinforcing the idea that this community is just servant, they're just service recipients, and we are the bringers of largesse? We want to move away from that model. And we want to move toward a model that is engages the community as an asset in our process and in our thinking and in our problem solving, because they are. Does it authentically reflect what a result means in Oakland. You know, does it close disparities? Does it, you know, does it increase community engagement and civic vitality? Does it, you know, all the things that Oakland cares about and most cities care about. So make sure it's in that context too. So measures look similar across the country, but you will have information. You will be able to find information about Oakland. There's a lot of data about Oakland, in particular in your area of work. And you want to review it disaggregated by race and ethnicity. And if we don't, you're not going to have problems with this. This is an area where I think you're going to be able to have plenty of data. The question is how you use the data. And we use the data to have conversations that with the community that talks about root causes. And it is critical to getting the answer right. The data just tells us the disproportionate outcomes of the system, how disproportionately the systems are functioning. We want to ask why are the disparities still there? Why are they still there? In order to move past the superficial understanding of the sources of the disparities. We all have an assumption and maybe even some information, but we're also likely to have plenty of misinformation. Like poverty and violence are always, they always go together, and yet violence and poverty don't always go together. So that's a simplistic answer. In the United States, it is a predictor, but it doesn't always, it's not locked in when it comes to human behavior. And we want to move past those superficial understandings of the sources of these inequities and get to the underlying history, causes, experiences, present day experiences, past experiences that the people that are impacted have had to help us understand what happened. You know, it's not, I mean, what happened is, we say, well, what happened is they became homeless, but that's too simplistic. That's at the very end of the pipeline when it comes to housing security. So what happened? What was the driving force of becoming homeless? And we ask why 3 to 5 times. It's called a root cause analysis. So when you answer it the first time, you say, well, why that? And then you keep interrogating, you keep going down, right? And that's important because along the way, we will find many opportunities for interventions, basically. What you're uncovering is opportunities. Oh, that happened. Well, that might be something we could do something about. Oh, that happened. Well, that's something outside of our jurisdiction, but maybe through a partnership, we could do something about that. Oh, that happened. Well, that's a thing that we already have a program for, but obviously the people who need it don't know it exists, and we need to connect them. You get the drift. It opens the discussion up for a more explicit set of problem-solving conversations that might even lead to partnerships or way outside the box thinking. And that's what we want, because staying inside the box is not closing the disparities. That's why the system is failing, not because of the people that are in the system, not because we're not working hard enough, not because we don't care. It's failing because we haven't adequately connected our strategies to root causes that would have a bigger impact and make a bigger difference in people's lives. That's not an exercise that is typically done. We want to do that. We want to use, in this process, skilled, preferably multiracial facilitation to push back on views that reinforce racism and actively surface the historic and present day root causes of that underlie the assumptions. So when I do anti-racism training, which you're getting, you know, kind of a smattering of today, but when I do the whole academy in the city of Oakland, I get people pushing back, coming from their mistaken assumptions, their poor education, their unconscious bias, and their internalized racist ideas about different groups of people. It comes oozing out. So you need to have skilled facilitation to gently but effectively interrupt those misperceptions about what's going on here. And we have to fight the dominant narrative that people get what they deserve, that we live in a meritocracy, and they are where they are because of all the poor choices that they made. They may have made poor choices, don't get me wrong, but I guess there's a really good line in a new television series somebody told me about, but we don't all have the same choices to make. You know, it's not always that people made good choices, it's that people had good choices. I think that's the piece that's from the TV series. I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because that's the situation we're in. Not everybody has the same choices. So okay. We don't want to get stuck in. Yeah?
Okay.
Yeah, I'll see you later.
Okay.
All right. That's not a question for me, I assume. But if it is, go ahead and let me know. So what are the factors that contribute to the racial disparity that you can see in the data? You want to get really clear about that. What are the factors you anticipate affecting in the future? You might want to anticipate some things that are coming. Unemployment benefits are running out, or the moratorium bans, freezes are going to lift at some point. That's a future factor, right? And we know it's going to disproportionately impact BIPOC populations. What are the causes and forces at work? What are the possible leverage points? And we want to dig deep into trying to identify the root causes, ask why 3 to 5 times. So these are just root cause. We want to examine them closely because we could be leaving stuff on the table. What I have found in my experience as a bureaucrat, and I've been a bureaucrat for a long time, I'm not ashamed to say that, is that you can have a lot of V8 moments. You know, could have had a V8. Why didn't we think of that? When you get into these root cause analysis, because it's just things that we haven't seen yet. So consider how current policies and services systems maintain or reinforce structural and institutional racism. Some of the stuff that's going on is just out and out racist. Now, that doesn't mean that the people that are involved in it are racist. It means that it has an unequal impact on Black, Indigenous, and people of color. It means that it's built into the structures and systems to operate that way. And it may have even been the DNA of it may be in a time when that was quite intentional. It's no longer intentional. The kinds of things that are embedded in the history of redlining are an example of that. Redlining, you know, it was created in the 30s and the 40s, but its impacts go on today. And nobody even has to think about it. It's so normalized now, these many years later. So we want to be really thinking about what is in this that is really directly hurting people of color and people of color communities. And we want to actually have that informed by the brainstorming that we did on root causes. We're going to get a lot of hints about where these barriers are built into our system that we didn't intend to be there. And even at the client level. So here's one of the things that we discovered in looking at the homelessness service data. I'll give you an example. Black people return to homelessness. Well, first of all, Black people are very overrepresented in homelessness in Oakland. And any place where there's a large Black population, Black folks are overrepresented in homelessness. It's not just Oakland, but first of all. Second of all, Black people who receive homeless services return to homelessness at a much higher rate than white people do. What we discovered was that not only do we not have the programs that are necessary to address the needs of Black people, particularly in the Bay Area, but this is probably true everywhere. Haven't been everywhere. Just don't exist. They've never been developed. They've never been funded. They're not there. So the services that I would need to offer the Black resident of Oakland who became homeless in the way that most Black residents of Oakland become homeless, i.e. being simply priced out of the housing market, displaced from their home and being poor and not having enough money to pay the rents that are available to them in Oakland means that they will be homeless and stay homeless and that more people are going to become homeless. So we got to that. The analysis delineated that. We already knew it, but it's now researched and documented. The other thing we found, though, was that within the housing services that are available, that Black people were more often placed with friends and family and considered housed. They exited housing services by being placed on a couch. And that same strategy was not offered at the same level of frequency to white participants. That is embedded unconscious differential treatment and would be defined as systemic racism. Do the people that are doing it realize that they're doing it? They're certainly not, no, and they certainly aren't doing it on purpose. It has many reasons why it's happening, but that root cause analysis began to unpeel. Why does that happen? How does that happen? What could be the things that could be done to keep that from happening? So basically the homelessness, both homelessness and returns to homelessness are built into our systems. They're actually built in. Nobody has to do a bad thing. It's going to keep producing these outcomes until we fix the systems. And that's what we want to get to. That's a root cause. I don't know if that's helpful, but that's a real life recent example. And there's about to be a report on it published, and I think it might change the whole conversation about how we're dealing with homelessness. I hope it changes, or at least raises the bar. No one program or policy will produce a result, but over time, multiple strategies can have an impact. It is cumulative. The impacts of systemic racism are cumulative. The impacts of our anti-racism or pro-equity acts will also be cumulative. It's reverse engineering what is currently in place. So we want to identify a large number of strategies in multiple categories. This is not a research project for evidence-based practices only. Let me say that again, because I know this is a big thing in the world of human services. This is not a research project for evidence-based practices only. Because trust me, in that homelessness scenario that I just gave you, they were using evidence-based practices, but they were evidence-based practices that only worked for part of the population, not for all of the homeless population. So we don't want to just rely on evidence-based practices because they tend to be biased. The same bias is built into the evidence of those practices that is built into the rest of our society. Nothing is outside of this dynamic. So another way of thinking about how to develop strategies is this other list here that has been provided. Low cost, no cost ideas. Ideas identified through community knowledge. Promising practices. Evidence-based practices. Out of the box, imagine if ideas. We want to really stretch the edges of how we conceptualize solving problems related to racial disparities. If we don't, we will keep getting what we've got. And it's not good enough. We're not satisfied. You know, we're just not. And as you're going through this process, do not get too attached to solutions. Consult with and gather community wisdom again before running down the road. Lead with an allyship attitude, co-conspirator attitude, partnership, true partnership attitude. We are still leading because we are responsible, but we want to have a different, we want to come differently to the conversation with the community. And not because, not just to make the community happy, but because we'll have better results. We'll have happier results. We'll be proud to be accountable for those results. So performance measures are the hard work. Identifying solutions that are connected back to one or more of the indicators, that's a disparity. And identifying the performance measures that show how your work is connected to those indicators, and using those performance measures to track your impact over time and to make course corrections as needed to get closer and closer to true north. So when we look at measurements, we don't just look at how many people did we serve. We don't even just look at who did we serve, although we do want to measure that. We want to look at, did the solution work? Compared to the intended impact, is anyone better off as a result of it? And who's better off? Articulated as a measure. This is the difference between doing business as usual, which has produced racially inequitable outcomes for generations, and being accountable for the impact of our work. Is anyone better off? Are those who are most marginalized better off? And how do we know? This is a growth area. Nobody has this perfect, but this is what we're really leaning into in order to get to a different place. Maybe not tomorrow, but soon. So a few equity RBA opportunities in releasing an RFP, and I made these specific to your RFP to the best of my ability. I may have gotten it wrong, and you can help me if I did get it wrong. I don't mind that because this is not my content expertise area, but staff helped me study up a little bit. So you have four buckets in the funding stream that are to be addressed, and they're very broad, and they're very inclusive. Fortunately, so you're not really hampered by these buckets, but at every turn, there should be disparities called out and linked to these areas of emphasis, to these areas, these target areas, if you will. In order to sort these out and make some better sense of them, we want to look at the disparities that are related to them. at least one disparity in any area that you're currently funding a program or would like to be funding a program. You want to share that. It's sometimes called an existing conditions analysis or step, where you actually connect your responsibility area to specific disparities. This helps give us clarity about what we are trying to actually impact out there somewhere in the future, collectively through all of our actions, not just this particular area, this particular programming, but all of it. We want to have all of it tying back to those across the whole city, tying back to those disparities. So you currently, as far as I know, in your RFP or in your background materials are not doing this yet. And this is where you would need to start to do a more equitable process, actually make this a part of what drives your conversation from the very beginning. What are the disparities in these areas that you would like to see shrink over time through collective action? I know it seems a little bit weird because it's like, yeah, but there's no one program is going to do that. But again, think about this as a collective impact exercise. If we get everyone pulling in alignment, we will have an impact. So it's not just here, but across the city, and in fact, across the whole society, ideally. We'll get there. Another area I looked at was to look at, did I skip one? Yeah. So we have a new Department of Violence Prevention, and you have a violence prevention element in your directive. And in fact, I think almost everything in this realm actually has the potential to be related to violence potential, to violence prevention. You could say it's all violence prevention. And you would be correct. But there's actually an explicit call out for violence prevention too. And so I know you probably have some programs that are explicitly doing violence prevention, but we really need to deepen this, and this goes back to violence and poverty. And having a more nuanced and sophisticated way of thinking about violence and poverty, because it's not just violence and poverty, it's not just violence, it's all the other negative outcomes for the community that are related to the same condition, the same situation that was created by the history of race and racism in this country. So in the violence prevention model that the city is now working to implement, we drill down into violence prevention differently, so we don't just think of violence prevention as tertiary programming. Tertiary is the end of the pipeline. That is when the target population is violence involved already, if I have my vocabulary straight. It is a relatively small segment of the population of the city of Oakland that gets addressed by those programs. It is the people who've been most traumatized and most damaged and most, you know, by whatever has gone on, and there they are, involved in violence and involved in the criminal justice system, and we're trying to retrieve them. It is a retrieval process, trying to rehabilitate, trying to pull people out of their involvement in violence, and thus improve the conditions in the community. That's not a bad thing for the community, but it is very far down the pipeline. So we want to go up the pipeline and connect this through all of our programming in the city, and not just in human services, but in other departments as well. We have convened and are talking about how can other departments get involved, if not in tertiary activities, in secondary, primary, and community. These are four legs of the table that I am not experienced in and could not go much deeper than this little bit that you're getting here. But it is actually now an intention of the city to align our activities in this mind model. It's just a mind model, but it gives us a way to, again, become more specific about root causes and proper strategies depending on the population that we're addressing. Secondary population, I'm going from the bottom up, is probably the area that we have least information about and least specificity on how we're addressing it. This is true across the country too, not just here in Oakland. That this target population are youth displaying violence proximate behavior, but not yet involved. They haven't yet picked up the gun. They haven't yet, stepped over that line into the realm of the population that would be involved in tertiary. Primary, I think, is the thing that most cities are all in on. The target population is all youth in harm's way. And we know that that's disproportionately Black, Indigenous, Latino, some Asian, not all though, but some Asian populations. And we know that we have a lot of youth in this category, and we tend to calibrate the majority of our activity around this area. I am not saying that's wrong. I think that makes sense because it's quite far upstream. So that's good. That's not a bad thing. But the question is, what are we doing about secondary? We also have quite a bit of activity and a lot of money going into tertiary. We have a lot of money, mostly through ceasefire, but not just through ceasefire, but a lot of it is ceasefire money and Measure Z, so it comes in differently. But anyway, it's still a lot of money, and we got to stop thinking of these as separate buckets. It's all city resource, and it may come from different places, but we've specialized in primary and tertiary. Secondary and community, less so. And I think of community as building community self-determination, self-management, self-help, healing, skill building, community, investing in community-driven and run organizations, really working on how do we partner in all of our departments to support the building of community self-empowerment assets. I don't know. There's a lot of language about this. None of it's quite right. But where we are actually giving it over to the community, giving support over to the community so that they can asset build, which is a foundational piece to make all these other pieces go better. Makes primary, secondary, and tertiary work better if you have the community piece going. And that is another area. So this is Guillermo Cespedes's work, or the work that he's bringing into the city. I don't think it's just his work, but this is an approach. It's a public health approach. It is different than the way we usually think about, than historically our society has dealt with violence prevention, which has been mostly crime and punishment. So this is a big swing away from that. And I think this is the year now that we have a Department of Violence Prevention and the expertise of a violence prevention expert who's done this work all over the country and, in fact, all over the world, to bring this model into your thinking. And it doesn't, I mean, a lot of what you're doing would already fall into different buckets here. I don't know the programming well enough, but you all do, that you could sort it this way. And I think that scan is needed because I think we need to see the gaps. And we also need to measure the outcomes in this framework. When we do measurements, we need to think about the outcomes for primary work is that those youth stay out of the pipeline. Are we really measuring that? Do we follow clients longitudinally? And if not, why not? Why aren't we doing that? Because how do we know if we're successful if we don't do that? Secondary measurement's going to be notched up a little bit different, because it's more retrieval and then tertiary. I think we track tertiary pretty well, actually. But it's these other areas, the other three areas, that I think we have an opportunity to really become more intentional and more aligned. And this is very important because I'm terrified, and so is anybody who's paying attention, about what's going on with violence in our city right now. We have got to get this right. We clearly don't have it right, or it wouldn't be falling apart. We thought we were making a difference. But what it took to reverse years of progress in this area was one pandemic. And it's a big deal. The pandemic's a big deal, but do we understand how those dots connect? We have to understand that better. It's not for lack of ceasefire. It's not for lack of lots of primary services. But I think it might be in the gaps. Some of it might be in the gaps, and some of it might be in the strategies themselves. I don't know. That's what we're analyzing for. We want to understand this better because we are in a world of hurt around these homicides, and it is Black people who are dying. So this is one of the big disparities for Black folks, and we have to address it. Just remember that meaningful solutions have to involve community. I borrowed this image. And by the way, I'll turn over this deck to you. You can have it. I'll send it in a PDF form if I have. Yeah, I didn't do that yet. The image, this goes to communities of color creating healthy environments. This was a community-driven process and a community-driven design around childhood obesity, right? And it also embodies a public health model. And I'm not saying that you do this exact thing, but I wanted to reinforce how incredibly important this is. It's so important that it's popping up in all kinds of arenas because it works. So this is just really me credentialing myself a little bit with what other people are doing. This is really where we're going. And we're going here because it makes a difference. So we want to really open up your process for new strategies to emerge. This is a repeat of a previous slide, just to reinforce that this repetitiously funding the same programs over and over again, while our homicide rates soar, or whatever it is, or while we don't really make a dent in childhood sex trafficking, or, you know, whatever your focus is, we have to be interrogating that. For not only are we doing evidence-based practices, but are we doing what works in Oakland? The data might suggest that we could improve. I don't know how much, but we could do better. So result-based about accountability really emphasizes this model of performance measures at the programmatic level, not just number of people served or number of activities, not even just how well did we do it, did we adhere to the model, et cetera. But also, is anyone better off? Who's better off? In what way are they better off? Skills and knowledge, attitude, opinion, behavior, circumstances. We want to start measuring these things. That has to be set forth in your RFP. If you don't tell your providers that we're going to add this bottom box on, so I think we've got the top two boxes well covered in current evaluations, program evaluations. We want to add on this box. We want to flesh it out. We have some of this, but we want a lot more, because you can see the bottom box is bigger because that's the most important thing. That's the money, as my daughter-in-law would say. That's what matters. All these other things are just on the path to getting to the bottom box. So we want to know about how we're doing in that way. I think that's it. Yeah. I can shut up now. And I'm okay.
Thank you so much. Did anyone have any questions for Director Flynn?
I'll turn this off too so I can see faces. I can't see faces when I have that PowerPoint up, and I hate it. So if you were frowning at me or shaking your head, I don't know that.
Yeah, Dr. Flynn, thank you so much for that report. Really brings back a lot of work that's been done over the last 30, 40 years. Of course, maybe you weren't around then, but...
But I called on it. I learned it from other, you know, it's all critical race analysis, all that is in there, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, so, at least 40 years. You bet.
Yeah, Dr. Cobb and all those in San Francisco had done a lot of work on that, so I appreciate your content and your delivery. So I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And how exciting is it that institutions like the City of Oakland and other cities across the nation are embracing that work? Because 40, 50 years ago, I know that these brilliant academics were basically talking to each other most of the time. It was very hard to engage institutions, and we have evolved, I think, as a society, into our ability to grapple with some of these concepts that are very, very challenging to the status quo. It's hard. It's not easy work. But we have grown to a place where we're having this conversation in the general public and in our institutions. And that, I think, is the difference between my experience and my father's experience in this country. That advancement that we've made, where we can come to actually naming this and relying on history and data and not just opinion about people to figure out what the right next thing is to do. We have grown, we just haven't arrived yet. We haven't gotten over the finish line.
Awesome. Well, do we have any additional questions or comments? If not, thank you, Dr. Flynn, for a very robust presentation.
I so love that you're calling me Dr. Flynn, but I'm not.
I mean, Director Flynn. I'm
sorry. And the reason I like it is the latest flap about the first lady elect. She should not be using her doctorate in her, but I really shouldn't be using it because I don't have a PhD.
Director Flynn, please change that for minute purposes.
Thank you very much. And please think of this as an active thing that we're doing together. It's ongoing, it's iterative. Hopefully I've given you some stuff to think about, and do feel free to invite me back if you want to drill down more in any of these areas, because this was a pretty high level overview and I understand that. I don't expect that it's going to do itself. So keep me posted, right, Sandy?
Absolutely. We've learned a lot just in the last several months, just participating in the trainings you've had from staff, and really sort of appreciate just the entire framing context and analysis that we can bring to the fore and start with. So I think it's going to be, you know, challenging, as you said. A lot of it is exploring and inquiry and you know, working in community during this crazy time. And
I know. It's not going to be easy. No, I know. One of the things I think your community-based organizations can do is they might be able to help you figure out how to organize some contact with the communities that they serve, or, you know, there might be some great, I know there's some partnership opportunities. So we have a work group in the city that's been working on outreach and engagement, and they've started really focusing on COVID and how to do it during COVID. So we can connect you with those resources too. It's just a peer group, but they're figuring it out, and it might help support you. Yeah.
Yes. And so we'll, I mean, I think it is a lot for people to process. I was, you know, looking forward and wondering if any folks have really, I know people have some other things that are going through their minds. They may just be a little bit shy about it because it is a lot, I think. But if, you know, we will pick up in January and we will be thinking through how to push further and how to apply more deeply to the initial phase of just envisioning some of this work. We won't have all, you know, the data done or anything like that, but, you know, in terms of you, the commission members as leaders, we think it's great to have this as initial context, and we can sort of try to figure out how to frame it so we can draw you more into applying it to the visioning and goal setting for the commission to start the process. And then again, it is iterative. It's not like it will be like final.
That's right. That's right. Each round, each time we have an opportunity to approach this, we'll be able to go deeper because of what we've learned in the last round. So it's about getting started.
Yes. And I do think that we'll be figuring out ways that we can come back and bring you back. And I hope that, you know, we can, you know, have your presence. I know that you are extremely busy and really want to thank you for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. I want to thank all of you and particularly the volunteers in the room today. We do, you know, I just feel like it's a privilege to work for an organization that has made this commitment and has given me the opportunity to really do this work in a deep and meaningful way, in an honest way, in a true way. Here in Oakland, and that's not everywhere. I just want you to know that. Not every city, having come from Seattle, is as ready and as willing to grapple with some of these hard things, and I think that's because things are harder in Oakland and we're used to hard things, and that sort of sets us up to be more interested in challenging ourselves, and I just think we're lucky to be here in this moment, other than the COVID thing. We're lucky to be here in this moment in a city that is encouraging, as a matter of fact, insisting that we do this. It's pretty exciting. It's a lot of permission, a lot of authority. And so we need to use it. So thank you.
Thank you. Awesome. So now we will continue on with our agenda, and I believe it's administrative updates next.
Thank you, Darlene. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Darlene.
So as by way of administrative update, we really just need to think a little bit about the meetings coming up in January, and particularly for the full commission. Normally the first Wednesday would be January 6th. And I'm going to, recommend Mike and I just sort of discussing how we can set the commission up to have a deeper discussion. But I think January 6th is too soon because of the January 1st holiday and all that good stuff. So we would be wanting to look at January 13th. And then the other thing is that I do think, I'm not exactly certain when I get updated sort of budget information and work through the guidelines that the city's going to be giving us. But that would more likely happen, I think, in February. If we did have anything that would be possible for you to entertain sooner, we would do that. But I'm fairly certain that the commission, we will keep you aware as soon as we're able. But so January 13th is my suggestion for the Planning and Oversight Committee. Maybe the other alternative would be January 20th, but I know we also want to have a time set up for the Strategic Planning Subcommittee, which really will go deeper into the planning work with consultants to support this. So
I'm sure on the 13th, what time were you anticipating?
We would just keep the regular 6 p.m. time.
Okay. That's fine with me.
Yeah, either time works for me as long as it works for everyone else.
Unfortunately, I'm actually unavailable on the 13th at 6. I have a conflicting meeting, but I am available on either the 20th or the 27th.
Okay, that's something to keep in mind.
Is it possible just to send a doodle with the dates and let people select, and then based on the majority, just select that date?
Yes, we can do that. And actually, because we're under a different emergency guidelines under the Brown and Sunshine Act, we don't actually have to have it on a Wednesday. But we do have to make sure that we have, it's a special meeting. We have to have, we want to have a 48-hour notice, I think is the requirement. We can definitely do a doodle poll. We routinely have had to do those before during years like this when the timing is so, it's critical, and it's not like everything is, set. Yeah. We have to be a little bit more flexible.
Yeah.
But we'll do a doodle poll for that. And Strategic Planning Subcommittee, Mike, I can't remember if you got any further with that or you want to send out potential dates to the subcommittee.
No. When we talked yesterday, I think it was Sandy, we were talking about later in January. We need to work with the group, and we'll do a doodle poll as well. Okay. So I want to work with you, Bill, and Peter, and Kimberly, as well as Tatiana around and Langston around a date for the subcommittee, looking at late January. And again, as an ad hoc group, since you guys, you're not beholden to the Wednesdays. So I want to have Caitlin help set up a doodle to get some good dates for you. But we would like it.
I'm good. I'm good.
Hello. You're great, Bill. You're really flexible, man. And what we'd like is that we want
to. I'm on relief. You guys are the one working. I'm on relief, so I'm pretty flexible.
Yeah. I'm wanting to get jumping on this too. And I think what we're gonna want is the PSC meeting to have that really grounding in that vision, mission, values, and a conversation around guiding principles and outcomes, and then get into the subcommittee and then jump into looking at some of this data and digging into. Really kind of the framework Darlene and just presenting for everybody. So we'll do the doodle poll looking at now late January.
We'll definitely do that. We can't really afford to lose any members in terms of attendance. And I think that, the 20th may be problematic, I think, for Anna Carita, and possibly Kimberly. So we'll take a stab at that.
My recommendation only is to let's take a stab quick so that it gets, for me personally, my calendar will be open and then it will fill up fast. So we can just secure a date as soon as possible so we ensure as many of us can attend.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll work with Caitlin to do those.
All righty. Well, there are no other administrative updates or comments or concerns. We will adjourn this meeting at 8:01.
Okay.
All right, thank you. You guys have a
happy New Year and grateful
holiday season.
Be very safe.
Yeah.
Jorge, I'm pleasantly impressed by your continued commitment and that and loyalty to the Oakland Traders.
You know, I've been everything Oakland, and unfortunately they're gone, but they'll live in my heart. So
I feel the same way. When I went to visit the stadium about a couple months ago to visit my aunt, I honestly couldn't be mad. It's so nice. I was like, I get it. So I'm with you. But I still jump with joy when they lose. So
you guys are serious. I used to buy season tickets. My roommate and I, we had